Welcome to the Victory Podcast.
Hey, Victors, welcome to this episode of the Victory Show. If this is the first time you're joining us, I'm Travis Cody, best-selling author of 16 books, and I've had the privilege of helping hundreds of business consultants, founders, and entrepreneurs write and publish their own best-selling books as well. And in that journey, I've discovered a really fascinating pattern. Many businesses hit a revenue plateau, usually around $1 million, and they struggle to break through that. Why is that? So on this show, I sit down with some of the world's most successful CEOs, leaders, and business owners to uncover the strategies they used to overcome those plateaus and scale their businesses to new heights so that you can do the same. So get ready for some deep insights and actionable takeaways that you can implement in your life and business starting right away. My guest today is James Miller III, a dynamic leader and seasoned entrepreneur whose career spans strategic growth, business transformation, and high-impact franchise operations. James is the former CEO of Vision Investment Group, where he scaled the Subway franchise operation from just 2 locations to over 50, growing revenues from $250,000 to more than $20 million. Now, here's the great one. We're going to get into this story. He also played a key role in creating Subway's iconic $5 footlong promotion, which went on to generate a staggering $3.8 billion in sales. It's the most successful promotion in the company's history. James has a deep expertise in multi-unit management, M&A, brand positioning, and executive leadership. And he's also held numerous C-suite roles across industries, and he served on over 20 boards, including Subway, Western Resorts, Marriott, Vistana Signature Experiences. Today, as the founder of Ignite Consulting Group, he advises businesses seeking bold transformation and sustainable growth. Now, here's that. Beyond just the boardroom and all that, James is also all about momentum. So from renovating villas to climbing 7 mountains in just 5 days, his personal story reflects grit, resilience, and a thirst for challenge. And his hobbies say it all. They all end with ING. Surfing, hiking, biking, running, fishing, traveling, wine drinking, and above all, serving others. So James, thanks for being here. I'm so excited for our conversation today.
Hey, thank you.
Where do we start? There's so many stories.
Oh my gosh. You tell me. I can start whenever you want to start.
Well, I love it. This show is all about scaling businesses. And I think a lot of people, you know, most get the entrepreneurial bug in their 20s. It kind of starts tickling in their brain. And then maybe in their 20s, their 30s, they start to do something about it. For you, that started a bit earlier. Let's talk about that.
So I grew up on a farm. I knew all about hard work from day one, and 7 days a week. 6 days a week we would work, and the seventh day we'd be in church and you know, rest and so forth. But that's, you know, grew up in the Midwest. That was very common, and I'm very proud of that background. It taught me so much about resiliency and hard work and so forth. But I think it was about the age of 13 when I told my dad I want to go off to college. And of course, I didn't really have any funds to do it, and he didn't have the funds to support me. Mom did not have the funds. We had a pretty meager lifestyle on the farm, and so I had about $50 or $60 at that time, and I bought a male pig and a female pig, and started my own breeding operation, and raised that into over 250 head of hogs. And as you already know, the name of my company was Macon Bacon, and then sold that off as I entered into college to help pay.
How long did it take you to get to 200 pigs?
Oh, that's a good question. Pigs are not quite as fast as rabbits, but you have the right pigs, and they will certainly continue to make more.
Oh, that's fantastic. Did you go into school then thinking business, going to get a business degree, or did you go to school to figure it out?
Well, I first started off in law, business law.
And all right.
Then after the reading syllabus was handed out, and it was page after page after page of all these boring books, I then went the opposite way and went into business, computer science, marketing. So that's where my focuses were.
You know, I used to work in Hollywood. I worked in Hollywood for 15 years, and my mentor started in law, and he was doing tax shelters. And he ended up becoming a producer eventually, and it made me laugh because we'd have meetings and he would talk about stuff, and somebody was like, oh, I wish I had a law background like you, because he knew a lot. And then his response always was, the only thing my law degree taught me was when my attorney's trying to overcharge me.
That's about right. So from tax shelters to Hollywood producer, that's a story.
So when you got out of college, did you go right into business, or you got business, you got marketing, you got computers, which one pulled you the most?
Gosh. You know, so during college, an interesting story is we had an adjunct professor who really liked what he was teaching on business. He liked the way I was thinking and rationalizing business and asking him a lot of questions, because I really, that's where my mind was going, was business, right? And one day he pulled me after class. He says, I want you to write a thesis. I want you to pick a company, talk about how you would scale and grow that company, and then we're going to submit that to the company. And I said,
wow.
Okay.
What a progressive professor. I mean, that's fantastic.
Right. And this goes back a ways. You're talking pre-internet, right? We had libraries, we had newspapers, magazine articles. That's where you're gathering all your information from. So anyway, I chose this little company based out of Bentonville, Arkansas, called Walmart. And I put together a growth strategy. Yeah, they were at that time. But put together a growth strategy on how I would grow them across the United States. The professor signed off on it, so it was very good. And it was mailed off. I think it was to Sam Walton directly at that time. I don't recall now. But
wow.
But interestingly, about a month goes by, and I think I'm a junior in college at this time. A month goes by, and I'm sitting in class. A student comes and says, hey, you need to get to the dean's office right away. And I said, well, I'll get there after this class. And he said, no, you need to go right now. And I was a little worried because I was an RA, and I had a gentleman on my floor who had tried to commit suicide a few times. And I was very concerned that that time had happened, right? That he was successful. Fortunately, that was not the case. But when I walked into the dean's office, there was this man who looked like a linebacker of a football team. He had this incredibly beautiful pinstripe suit on. I'd never seen such a beautiful suit. And the dean introduces me to him and then walks out the door and leaves me with this gentleman. And I am shaking. And he looks at me very sternly, says, where did you get this growth plan? And I said, well, it's something I came up with that my professor suggested I do and submit. No, I need to know exactly where you got this information. And the third time I told him, I said, I really came up with this idea myself. I did some research. This is how I'd grow Walmart across the United States. And he puts his finger in my chest. And then he smiles and says, what you put together is about 95% accurate with what our actual 10 to 15 year growth strategy is. Would you like a job after college? So anyway, I had that set up for as soon as I left college, but I didn't accept the job because they were actually going to require me to move every 2 to 3 years. And that was just like, I'm not ready to do that. I promised my family I'd at least come home for a couple of years to help with the farm, as well as look for that full-time job. And then I was given an incredible opportunity as a college student just graduated to be a co-chief marketing officer for the world's largest popcorn company.
Which company was that? Redenbacher?
That is, close. A Weaver Popcorn.
Oh, wow. All right. So let's talk about that. Kind of got thrown right in there. What was that first year out of college like? Because now you're going from theory into practical, right?
It was definitely, the fire hose, the fire, everything, right? So it was a common week was probably 60 to 70 hours. And I did that for 3 straight years. So
welcome to corporate life.
We talked about the best learning experience ever, but I had 7 salespeople underneath of me at my age. And so that was a huge learning curve on how do I understand people, the psyche of what they're going to think about me as being this underling who's now over them. And I'm helping them with 42 or 43 different states of customers, had 7 states of my own as my customers. And then the entire country of Canada was turned over to me as a customer, 330 customers up there. In addition to that, I'm in charge of coming up with new marketing materials, advertising, promotions, conferences throughout the United States and Canada, and new product development.
At nighttime, because daytime you're facilitating all your customers?
I don't ever remember taking a vacation during those 3 years.
So you're saying something that this is kind of the whole point of why I'm doing this book and doing the show, right, is that it's all about the leadership and the business growth. But what are, if you recall, what are 3 or 4 sort of key lessons you learned specifically about working with people at that age, at that sort of level of intensity?
I would say that leadership is less about having all the answers, because I certainly didn't. And it's more about creating the environment where the best answers rise to the surface. So for me, I had to be very real. I had to be very accountable, which I see a lot of leadership is not accountable in today's business organizations.
Yeah.
And that's a big failure, because it's okay to be accountable, and it's okay to make mistakes, and it's okay to admit those mistakes, because your teams will actually have bigger trust in you than they did prior. So we all fail. We just have to admit it. And you move on and learn from that.
You would never work in Hollywood, because The answer there is that no one fails and it's never my fault. And always, it's always someone else is wrong.
So, yeah, and some of that too is just doing your best to fit into the customer, I'll say, atmospheres. In Canada, I was actually doing a lot of work for Scouts Canada. They were using Weber popcorn products as a way to raise funds in the United States and Canada both. And so if you've ever had chocolate covered caramel corn, I brought that product to market back in the 90s. Son of the founder of Weber Popcorn did not like that at all. He said, "We're not a candy company. This is not going to go well." And the first year, it took 24% of the market share.
All right. So how did you develop that? Was that an accident? Was it going through beta testing? Were you doing workshops?
I reached out to Marty Palmer, who owns Palmer Candy Company in Sioux City, Iowa. And I said, "Marty, I need to come up with a product. It needs to be something unique. And I want to have some decadence to it," because our current product mix at that time didn't really had nothing with chocolate in it. So I flew up to Sioux City and literally we grabbed a shopping cart and we went to the grocery store and we went up and down every aisle and said, "We think we can dip this in chocolate. We think we can enrobe this in chocolate." And we picked up Oreo cookies and graham crackers and all kinds of things that now today you find them enrobed in chocolate.
But back then they were like graham crackers, chocolate. What are you thinking?
So quite literally we got done with this and I said, I just don't think we weren't meeting the mark for Weber Popcorn Company. So I had a tote of fresh batch of caramel corn sent out to Marty and said, "Hey, I'm going to come out. I want you to start experimenting with if you could possibly do this, covering this with chocolate." And we found a system that was, it started off pretty vulnerable, but we found a sweet spot on how to make it accurately and properly and be able to ship it all over the United States and Canada with quality. Then it started.
So what's interesting about that is I know most people are like, "Yeah, what's the big deal? You got caramel corn and chocolate," but the logistics of how do you cover it? How do you keep the chocolate hard? How do you keep it from sticking together? How do you keep it from not melting the caramel corn? I mean, the poor workers and they think, "Shoot, another batch of chocolate caramel corn didn't work. We'll have to take this one home. We'll chisel it apart with a hammer, but it's shoot." Right,
exactly. And for us, the biggest thing was quality. We used real milk chocolate. We didn't want to have any paraffins in it or something like that. So we wanted, because this was going to be a luxury product in the lineup that the Scouts were selling. And it worked very well. I can tell you that the Canadian Prime Minister at the time, I was at a conference and a dinner with him, and he awarded me his necktie for helping Scouts Canada increase their revenue. And, wow. So a little interesting tidbit.
You're right. You have had some unique stories along the way. All right. So let's get into, how do you go from popcorn into franchises?
Yeah. So I left Weber after about 3 years. Again, incredible experience. I'd never traded that in. And then went to another company for a short stint, about 16 months, brought them into the digital age of advertising, marketing, and sales and renting through the World Wide Web, as we would say back then.
That weird thing.
Yeah.
That Bill Gates said was a gimmick.
That's right. Help them expand into Canada and Mexico and help them poise themselves to be in a position to sell out to their largest competitor. But at that time, I was eating Subway anywhere from 3 and 4 days every single week. It was right down the street or right down the road from me. I liked the food. Employees knew me very well, so I'd get a lot of free cookies throughout the week. And I thought, why do I keep putting money into that business but getting nothing out of it except for just the food itself? Maybe I ought to consider buying a Subway. And I found two for sale and then grew that into over 50 across Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan. And that's where it started.
So were those two local there then? And was that store that you went to one of the ones for sale?
Yeah. So I didn't even know they were for sale. In the Subway industry at that time, people didn't announce it was for sale. They would just call another franchisee and say, "Hey, I'm considering selling." And the deal's done. You never hear about it. So it did happen to be that the one in my hometown, I talked to that family, said, "Yes, we're considering selling," because they were going to sell off a handful of Subways, and then they're going to get into a steakhouse concept, and they needed the cash to do that. So I bought two and went from there.
So had you already exited the other company? You'd help them exit. So did you end up kind of still working for them and then starting to grow your franchise business at the same time?
I was starting to work on the Subway deal as I was getting ready to exit that company.
Got it. All right. So obviously going from 2 to 50, that's a significant increase. How did you go about doing that?
Yeah, I think a lot of that comes down to it is people, right? We had, I think, 250,000, in money to over earn revenue to over 22, 23 million. A lot of it always the right people. So I can even tell you today that the first person I hired back in 1998 is still on my team today.
Wow.
And I think a lot of that comes, Travis, it's from providing a vision. It's providing that vision with clarity and rationale as to why we're going to grow and how we're going to get there in such a way that people are going to follow. If you don't have clarity and you don't have vision and you can't spell that out for them in a believable, genuine way, then you're not likely to have followers.
So what are the challenges you faced? So you got the two, and then did you immediately go, this is pretty great, I want to start expanding? Or did you sit down and I mean, was part of that vision going, I'm going to eventually have 50 stores?
I had this vision of growth. I can't stop. I mean, it's just, that's how I am wired. It's just to grow and scale, take the next challenge, grow that, and just keep going. That's just how I'm built. So the first challenge was actually to get to about 5 to 7 stores. So once I had these two and I kind of felt like I had some kind of control in place to where I wouldn't have to be at the stores all the time, I started talking with some other franchisees to see if I could buy another store or two. And as luck would have it, I had somebody called me and said, hey, we've got a franchisee who has some tax obligations.
That never happens in business.
He was his own accountant, and it didn't work out for him. Oh, no. So I took over his store for pennies on the dollar, and still have that store today. It's a great, great location. Wow. And then I met an older lady, and she and her son had 5 or 6 Subways. And I thought, man, it'd be great to buy these 5 or 6 Subways, but they were about 1.5 to 2 hours away. I can't be down there all the time. So I got permission to talk with somebody in the area that was overseeing those stores and put a deal together. And I went from 3 locations to 10 locations and just kept growing that way.
So from a leadership perspective and as business owner's perspective, what are the challenges that come from, going from 2 to 6 to 10 to 20? And how do you maintain the profitability as you're growing that quickly?
Yeah. So a lot of different things come into play. So at that time, here I am a business leader, but at the same time, for many years until I had about 15 or 18 locations, I would walk into my stores as the business leader, right? The owner of these locations. And yet there's a big key ring on my right side of my jeans because I'm there to work on a grease trap, replace a ceiling fan. I mean, maintenance, was a big part of it. And then pick up the weekly paperwork at the same time to take it home and sit at the table all night long and figure out what the schedule is for the next week and payroll and so forth. But when you get to a specific point, and for me, is it about 12 to 13 stores, I brought in this full-time, another full-time operations person. And I had teamed up with a local CPA firm and said, look, if you come in and back me on a couple of large acquisitions, I will make sure that your CPA firm has 100% of all my work, including the administrative side and the payroll side, because I just couldn't keep that on my plate. And I wanted to have somebody I could trust. And that's how I grew
up until 10 stores. You were managing that all on your own?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So we get to about 12, 15 stores, added that CPA firm, added another operations person. And then my sights were, okay, I want to get to 25. And that's what I set out to do. And it was through acquisition I got to 25. And then in the year 2011 and 12, this is right after the $5 footlong. Sales are going crazy for Subway. They've never had a down year since 1965. And Subway approached me and said, hey, do you feel like you have your kingdom built? And I said, no, I've just got the foundation put down. Let's really get going. So in about a 18-month time frame, I grew from 24, 25 locations to 2.
So you doubled in a 2-year period. And that was because Subway asked
right.
Offered that to
right.
you. Wow.
I will never do that again.
Okay. Let's talk about the challenges of going that fast. What happened there? Besides not much sleep.
What you find out is when you have that kind of a growth, especially when I think 14 of the units are new builds, it consumes every bit of cash flow, every bit of waking hour that you have. The multitasking and the project work was just, it was incredible. So it was difficult on my team. We've all looked back and said, hey, we learned so much going forward. We still really don't like the fact that you have students on the interiors. There was one, I will tell you, there was one weekend, Saturday night, I'm taking a look at cost, I'm taking a look at our labor and our food costs and so forth. send out to the team. I said, here's what I believe are the schedules and labor that we need to run starting Monday. And this went out on a Sunday. And at that time, I had three or four full-time district managers. They were reporting to my operations, director of operations. And nobody responded to me except for my director of operations. And he said, I just want you to know that you sent out to cover labor costs and food costs on Sunday. We call it Sunday Bloody Sunday because there's no bloody way we'll be able to follow this. Okay. And that's what taught me you have to have the team involved in major decision-making processes.
That's interesting. All right. But let's talk about where did the idea for the $5 footlong come from?
Back in probably 2006 or 7, I was helping a lot of regional and local subway advertising boards because I'd been a CMO twice over. And that caught wind in the system. And so I was elected to the boards. And then the national board, which oversaw a $900 million advertising budget for the United States, Canada, and Australia. Somebody on that board contacted me and said, hey, we'd like to have you on the board. You need to run. And I did run. I was elected. And so about that time, we were looking at, we'd come off the 2008, 2009. We're in the middle of that recession. You know, everybody's BMWs and boats are up for sale. And the second homes are no longer in the possessions and bank's possession. And we're trying to figure out a way to help basically the American people get through a tough time. And we had a franchisee in Florida who had been doing some interesting specials on the side. And we were watching that and we started to measure the analytics on that. This might be something that we can tweak a little bit and go national. So long story short, we came out that $5 footlong. It was an incredible experience for the country. And like you said earlier, it's $3.8 billion in revenue is what it brought the subway. And it was actually at one time in the Smithsonian Marketing Hall of Fame was the most significant restaurant marketing campaign in the history of the QSR business.
So from a revenue standpoint, was it sort of like just everybody strapping a rocket pack on their backs and they were like, what just happened?
It was. And of course, I worked very closely with the founder, Fred DeLuca, at that time. And I told Fred, I said, look, it's either this thing is going to go insanely incredible, beyond our wildest dreams, or it's going to flop. But I said, I really don't think it'll flop because just to think $5 and if somebody wants to buy a $5 sandwich, they surely have money left over to buy some chips, cookies or a drink. Well, that wasn't the case. So the $5 footlong sold. Like, it was just incredible, right? It was wildfire. But we did find out that people loved that price point so much, they didn't want to add another dollar, dollar and a half for side items. But although it was fantastic for our revenue, and it did help our profitability, we actually did lose some traffic in side items and drink beverage sales.
Did that create that rapid growth with that specific promotion? Did that create any logistical challenges for your guys' supply chains?
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. Again, we didn't expect this to take off quite the way it did. So, I was fortunately not heavily involved in the supply chain side of it. I mean, I knew when we were running out of product and we would be told, you can't get that product this week. You can't have that turkey. I'm like, well, turkey's number one.
So oh, no.
Hit some birds.
Wow. Well, there's nothing like running a promotion that's so successful. You're, I got a wait list.
That's correct.
But so what's
that? Yeah, the other part of that is a downfall, though, Travis. So my suggestion to Fred and the others agreed is let's do this for 1 or 2 years. If it goes extremely well, that's great. And then let's cut it off. Let's say in year two or year three, let's do, maybe it's specific sandwiches for $5 or whatever. But the brand liked the promotion so much they continued to run it. Got to a point where our customers now believed our sandwiches were only worth $5. And so it was difficult. When we got into 2012, or it's actually the summer of 2013, we had the first negative sales since the brand's existence from 1965. And then they started to do some couponing and discounting that went deeper. And they did that from 2013 to 2018. It did not drive traffic. It did not drive profit and it didn't drive sales. And that severely hurt the franchisee side of the system.
Interesting. So on the one hand, you're breaking records, but long-term, you're facing some headwinds.
Absolutely. And we liken it to, say, the pizza industry. There was quite a period of time where in the pizza business, you had to be discounting the coupon because every competitor was doing the same. So if you wanted to play in that market, you had to be deep discounting.
Yeah. Wow. So let's talk a little bit about you as a leader. So obviously you need a team to manage that sort of growth. So first and foremost, what do you look for in in a leader for your team? And then the second part of that is how do you support their growth as a leader over, you know, as they come on board and start to get over the first, say, 3 to 5 years?
So I learned this expression from someone else, but I've used it so for throughout my entire career. But it was the difference between eagles and turkeys. One of the things that we, when we hire somebody, we always hope we have the best person, right? The right person for the job. But if they come in and they're actually more of a turkey and they're not an eagle, unfortunately, you're likely to never be able to train that turkey to fly like an eagle, right? It might fly for a short distance, but it's not really going to be able to soar. And so one of the best things you can do, and it's also some of the hardest decisions you can do, is to get rid of the turkey as quickly as possible, because it's just never going to work out long term. The other part of that too is I believe great leaders are translators. So a vision of values and sense of urgency, especially in the fast food restaurant business and so many other types of businesses out there, you have to be having a sense of controlled urgency at all times, because as soon as you sit still for a minute, somebody has bypassed you. You have to continue to innovate. You have to continue to be moving forward. You just can't say, this is our brand and that's all we're going to be, because then your brand is going to die off. And the other part of that too is for each of my leaders, no matter whether they are a store manager, a district manager, operations officer, people don't understand where you're going and why it matters. They're not going to follow you there, and you have to have them follow me.
So how did you then go about figuring out how to translate your vision in a way that inspires people?
So one phrase that starts off very simple, and I love to say this to brand new store managers, right? Because I'd love to be able to talk to somebody at that level and say, I hope you make some mistakes this year. And they look at you quite strangely. You know, what's wrong with this guy? And I'll tell them, the reason I want you to make mistakes this year is because it tells me you're trying some things outside the box. And we need to be able to give people some autonomy to try some new things, still staying within your franchisor's operations policies and so forth, but finding a faster way to do something, finding a better way to advertise through word of mouth, a better way to run your operations and your staff and so forth. So that's where it starts, is at that level of giving them some autonomy and letting them know that you believe in them. The other thing I do, Travis, and this is just my own personal thing with all human beings that I come into contact. Every single human being that I come into contact with, I start them off at 100% or basically A+, and they will always be there on my side. It'll be their actions that might bring them down from that 100% or that absolute A+ level.
Wow. That's almost the opposite the way corporate world does it. They usually start with a B player and see if they can't nurture him, right? So now that you've been on the boards of some big companies, so you've been on the board of Westin, you've been on the board of Marriott, and so now you've got food, and now you're in the board of the hospitality companies. What were some of the— was there anything that was sort of eye-opening about getting into the hospitality side of business and seeing what they were?
Oh, so it's customers are completely different. It's the same customers, right? Whether they go to a fast food restaurant or go to, you know, a nice resort, it's still the same people. But what they expect from their visit is completely different. With fast food, you're typically, you have that 10 or 15 minutes maybe with that customer while they go through the line, sit down and eat quickly, and then get back to work. But when they're at, say, a resort, first of all, that person at the front door or at the front desk, that is an imperative and crucial place, because the very best part of their visit starts right there, or the very worst part of the visit starts right there.
Wow. No, that's true. That is fascinating. All right. And so let's talk about, for people listening to this show and maybe they're business owners and they're working around, let's talk a little bit about, like, I don't see a lot of people talking about this on shows. As a business owner, like, what are some of the most important metrics that a business owner can be paying attention to?
So I put it down into, and this is going to sound like I'm consulting, but I have had this conversation over and over again with so many different business leaders and board members. I have this philosophy and principle that there's three P's that you have to be very good at. Every brand, every organization, every company has three P's. They have people, they have a product or service, and they have to make a profit. All three of those you need to hone in on and do your very best to make sure all three happen, and that they're all three happening at the same time. As soon as one of those three P's is out of an alignment, then other things start to crumble around it.
So if you're good in one, let's say you're good with a people person, but you're maybe products. I mean, clearly for you, products is a natural, I would say, innate skill you've had, because you've developed some pretty fantastic ones. But for someone that isn't that way, like how can some, like a business owner, develop skills in one of those other areas where they may be weak?
Yeah, I think it depends on, I'll give you an example on board sites. Wasn't too long ago, I was helping with a logistics company. I'm not a guy who knows logistics, so to speak. I always think about UPS and FedEx and shipping and all of that. And I thought, well, I'm not really heavily involved in that. But logistics still comes down to three things. There's people involved, they have a product or service, and they need to make money. And there are specific key indicators in all of those three. And again, you want to make sure that all of those align. So I hate to keep preaching on that, but it's true. And leadership isn't necessarily about control. It's about clarity, right? So even if you don't know the product, you can learn the product. It's about clarity, and it's about honesty and knowing what you have. And it's your job as a leader to remove friction, communicate a clear direction, build a culture where people are excited to show up. And I've helped grow brands from a few hundred thousand to, you know, over 20 million in revenue, but I'm most proud of building teams that didn't just hit numbers, they grew people. And if you're growing the right people and you're nurturing those people and the culture is good, you're more and more likely to succeed just because of people.
So that's an interesting question then. So, because I hear this quite a bit from clients that I'm working with, where especially solopreneurs, they start off thinking, oh, if I can make a couple hundred thousand a year, it'll be great. Maybe they get successful and they get up to the 500,000 to 800,000 range. And suddenly they're like, I'm too busy to be able to manage this all on my own. How do you know what's the most important hire first?
Oh, there's a number of them. So I have definitely hired people where I didn't have a position for them. I just knew I would love to have them as part of our team, or I will keep that connection going until I know I have something coming up. Could be with an existing company, could be a new launch, could be even with, you know, helping with a specific project, just to have them into my company fractionally for a period of time. They can actually rub off some great learning experiences and culture to the other people around. So I just don't want to turn down good people. The other thing, as you're seeing too in the market now, and I'm getting heavily involved in this, is you don't always have to have a W-2 employee. So there are so many good people out there, either in the consulting side of things, or maybe they're fractional or interim C-level or other level, that they can come in and do a fantastic job on a specific project or to help with a specific hurdle or challenge in the company. And then when they're done, that's it. They're no longer considered, I'll say, baggage by way of labor costs.
Wow. Yeah. And I think, you know, the world we're moving into, a lot of people are, they don't want to be a W-2 employee. They want to come in and just work at a first small time. So what advice do you give when people are hiring you for consulting? What some of the advice do you give to the actual owners themselves? Not even about the team, but just looking at the person at the top of the pile. What are the things that so for me, I have my own business. What are some things that I need to be aware of as a business owner in terms of if I'm gearing my company for growth? What are my blind spots that I'm not seeing because I'm only at $1 million a year?
All right. So I think that goes back to a few things. First of all, I do want to say this. I've never found a better word for consultant. I don't really like the word. I always, you know, I've always thought about consultant being like compared to used car salesperson. And I'm sorry, audience out there, whoever's in the car business, I hope you're honest to goods. But there's kind of a negativity sometimes when a company says, oh, this consultant wants to talk to me or so forth. And I've heard that from many different leaders. But when I go in, I think there's a number of things that I'm going to identify through conversation with that leader. I want to find out, first of all, how they define success. And I want to know, is it just them who defined success for the business, or are they using, you know, getting the entire team involved in that definition? That tells me whether or not they're connected or not connected with the team. That's huge. Mm-hmm. I will tell you that growth without alignment is chaos. So I've seen great ideas fail because the team simply wasn't rowing in the same direction together in the same boat. And again, that goes back to you have to have followers, and they have to believe in what you are doing. They have to believe in your vision, and you have to cast that vision in such a way that it makes sense, it's believable, and it's achievable. So going back to trying to scale a business from, say, $1 million to 5 million. Well, I would, first thing I'm going to look at is, why do you want to get to 5 million? What does that do for the people? What does it do for the product or service? What does it do for the end consumer? What's the purpose? You've got to have a purpose for growing a business. The other is, I take a look at what they're doing in their brand strategy to find out if they're actually trying to grow the business through correct strategy, or are they just staying doing the same thing over and over again? Remember, it's Henry Ford that said, if you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you always got. And I believe there are many, many brands out there who just kind of rested on their laurels and said, hey, we've got the majority market share. They don't do the right things to either keep up with millennials and Gen Z and Gen A to attract those individuals in. And then their competition comes in and says, hey, we want that business. So we'll do the right things to take that business.
Blockbuster, 9,500 locations thinking they're untouchable.
Absolutely. Blockbuster could have become a Netflix and said, hey, let's do streaming instead of, you know, videotape.
The funny thing is Blockbuster actually had a streaming service. And then they got a new CEO and he's like, we're bricks and mortar store. We don't need the streaming thing. And I think Reed Hastings, the guy who founded Netflix, even said, if Blockbuster had continued their streaming company, like it probably would have ended Netflix. They wouldn't have gone anywhere. So, right.
Oh, it's incredible to think about that.
Okay. You've been super gracious of your time. Two last questions. What was the impetus to climb 7 mountains in 5 days? Is that what it was? Did I get that right?
Yeah. So again, I do anything with ING. I love being challenged. So it was in the fall of 2021. I had talked with 9 different friends and invited them to join me in Colorado. And the goal was to climb 5 mountains over 14,000 feet in the course of 7 or 8 days. Not a single one joined me, so I went on my own.
So if you're in Denver, do you have 7 or 8 of those within a couple hour drive?
You've got to move around a little bit just to be closer, but not too far up from Denver. You start getting your 14s heading to the west there. But so I went out there all by myself and started off one area and moved to another, but I ended up climbing 7 in 5 days. And I won't ever do that again.
I was going to say, was the second week a week where you were like having a challenging time walking around?
I can tell you, I almost canceled my flight home because I was so sore. I wasn't sure if I'd get to the airport.
All right. And I know this one's completely side, but I was so fascinated by the fact that you've rehabbed villas. What, where and why? That's the other one.
Are you talking about through the Marriott and Westin brand?
Yeah, that was one of your things. You said from renovating villas to climbing seven mountains in 5 days.
So. Right. So, well, I joined the board of directors at the Westin St. John Virgin Islands back in, I think that's 2016. It's new to the board. And really that first 6 months it's a big learning experience. So I'm just attending meetings and calls, listening to what's taking place, what's going on with operations. And the board then handles everything. Everything inside the four walls of the villas, everything outside from landscaping to waterfront, operations, engineering, editorial, food and beverage. It's every part of that. And then it was in September of 17 when Hurricane Irma hit. Mm. And then 12 days later, Hurricane Maria hit. And what I learned through that process is it was about a $260 million rebuild.
Wow. What a time to join the board. You get come on board and then like...
an incredible time. So... yeah, I'll say I enjoy renovating villas, but it was one of those challenges in life where you never expect something like this to happen. And what we found ourselves into was not just fixing some roof tiles or something like that. This was, everything was completely devastated. So every single part of that property had to be refurbished. And I can tell you, I'm not allowed to go into all the details, but I can tell you some of the extreme things where we ended up with a catamaran upside down in a swimming pool that came from a different island. I have pictures of palm trees sticking out the sides of buildings, like it was a toothpick that had been thrown in. Incredible damage. And one of the most weird, unusual damage that we saw was after cleanup and things are starting to come back to the island and the sea is calming down and so forth. We had numerous iguanas across the area with no tails. They had clung to the trees so tightly during the high winds that their bodies and their tails actually separated. Wow. So that was very unusual to see, but they're growing back and you don't hardly see any stub tails anymore.
The weather is so fascinating. I had some friends that lived in Texas and they were with a tornado. And the reason I remember the story is they built a custom house and a few years later, the wife bought a baby grand piano. And it wouldn't fit in the room that they had built for it. They didn't consider the door. And 4 years later, this hurricane hits, rips everything down. The roof of their house got ripped off. And they come home and the baby grand piano is in the room that they had originally, that Lynn had lifted it up over the wall. Roof of the house was gone and not a scratch on the piano. And then they said, we're like, well, we're never going to move the piano. It's always going to be in that. that thing. So anyway, I just find that fascinating. So what's next? So two things. What's next? Where's your vision for the next 5 to 10 years for you and what you're doing? That's question number one. And I'll ask you the final question.
Okay. You know, actually what I'm really loving right now is talking with emerging brands and franchisors, franchisees, and really any kind of organization that has, again, people, product or service, and needs to make a profit. I want to do more helping, consulting, helping. And that could be helping with the leadership team, operations, scalability, marketing. I love doing that. I love helping companies grow, which means, in my mind, that means helping leadership grow first. And that's really what I want to do, whether it be fractional or just whatever. I just love doing that. I love the board work. As you mentioned, I've been on over 20 boards of directors. I believe I've been blessed with a godly gift to help guide and lead. I want to use that to the best of my ability.
So who's a great fit for like an ideal client that would come to you? Who, like, is it a revenue range? If somebody's like, hey, I'm making $5 million or more, just or do they just need a people, product, service, and they want to make a profit?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've been part of several startups, and I think I would consider helping some startups again if they really have the right product and they've got a strategy for growth and have some, you know, some either some VC or private equity behind them to take off. But truly, it could be a $5 million revenue company or $500 million revenue. So I've helped all different kinds of brands. As you've probably seen, where I've helped Coca-Cola, Disney Films, Frito-Lay, Subway. It's just been all over the place.
I think Disney has completely forgotten whatever you helped them with. This last 5 years hasn't been so great for them. So that's the final question. If somebody's listening to this and they're like, oh my gosh, I want to work with James, how do they find you? How do they get in touch with the Ignite Consulting Group?
Simple as that. Just find me on LinkedIn. And there's not a lot of James Miller segments out there on LinkedIn. There's not a lot of Ignite Consulting Groups. I think there's only one that's based in the United States, and that's me and two other guys. It's just a team of three. We're a boutique firm, and we're doing it that way because we don't have overhead. We can come in and help with a specific hurdle or challenge very quickly, very flexibly, with a lot of adaptability and help. I mean, it's a roll up your sleeves type of situation. When we come in, we help. Once we've, you know, fixed it or helped them get along their way, then we're kind of like the Avengers. We come in, we help fix the problem, and we fly out of there.
I love it. That's awesome. The business Avengers.
That's maybe I should have changed our title to the Ignite Avengers. Yeah. Avengers firm.
Well, James, thank you so much for your time. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate it.